Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us today for the webinar, Increasing Access for Immigrant Children and Mixed Status Families. I am Cara Baldieri, Senior Policy Director for Family Economics at First Focus, which is a national bipartisan children's advocacy organization dedicated to making children and families a priority in federal budget and policy decisions. First Focus, CLASP, and Single Step co-lead the Coalition for Access and Opportunity, which is a multi-sector collaboration of advocates, researchers, and practitioners with the mission to share and publicize best practices, identify federal opportunities, and promote policy reforms that will strengthen the safety net by removing barriers to participation. First Focus has long been working to ensure that all children, regardless of their immigration status, have access to the critical services they need to grow and thrive. Today, we will hear from experts from around the country who are working to expand eligibility and improve access to means-tested benefits, healthcare, and other critical services for immigrant children and mixed status families. First, Aviday is the Economic Justice Policy Attorney at the National Immigration Law Center. Next, we will hear from Elizabeth Colvin, who is the Director of Ensure Central Texas, which is part of Foundation Communities. And finally, we will hear from Stephanie Altman, who is the Assistant Director of Healthcare Justice at the Sergeant Shriver National Center on Poverty Law. As far as logistics of the webinar go, audio for this webinar is accessed through this conference line that you should have received upon registering, and all attendees are currently in a listen-only mode. In the case that your computer is also trying to access audio through the webinar technology, please be sure that your computer speakers are muted so that we cannot hear any background noise. We will have time for question and answer at the end of the webinar. In order to ask a question, you will be able to press star 9 through your phone to raise your hand, and then you'll be unmuted and able to ask your question. If you are having any trouble in asking a question or generally with the webinar technology, please use the message function in the lower left-hand corner of the screen. This webinar will be recorded, and the recording will be circulated in the coming days following the webinar. So without further ado, I will turn it over to Aviday if she is on the line.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, great. Thanks, Cara, for the introduction, and thanks, everyone, for joining today's call. As Cara said, my name is Aviday Mousavian. I'm with the National Immigration Law Center. We are a national immigrant rights organization that's specifically dedicated to advancing and promoting the rights and opportunities of low-income immigrants. And we do that through both impact and class action litigation, as well as policy work here in our DC office where I'm based. So I'm going to go through basically a broader overview of access to public benefits, including means-tested federal public benefits, and what are some of the barriers that immigrants face in terms of what are the just general eligibility rules. Beyond that, what are some of the privacy, confidentiality concerns people face? What are some of the confusion, and sort of chilling effects that deter even eligible immigrants from accessing benefits? And also some of the things that you as advocates for your clients or community members can do to advance immigrant access to these different benefits. So that's just a quick overview of some of the topics we'll cover today. It's going to be a lot of information in a short amount of time. So, of course, both at the end and the question and answer session and beyond, certainly all of you should feel free to reach out to NILC for any other questions. So on the next slide, I'm going to just briefly describe some of the changes that occurred in major federal legislation that passed in 1996. The Welfare Reform Act that passed in August of 1996 drastically changed immigrant eligibility for federal public benefits. It used to be that more or less anybody who was lawfully present in the United States, regardless of what their specific immigration status was, as long as they were here with permission, that they would generally be eligible for most public benefits. However, in 1996, with this massive reform to our public benefit system, the the legislation created sort of two broad categories of immigrants, and they referred to them as qualified or not qualified immigrants. Now, I believe most people in this webinar are may not be as familiar with all the different types of immigration status, but for those of you who are, you'll know that qualified and not qualified are not terms that exist in immigration law. This is very specific to benefits classifications. So in terms of who's qualified and who's not qualified, sorry, I just got a notice that there's a couple folks on the phone who are having some issues with the audio. It may be that you haven't activated it, and hopefully you will be able to correct that. In terms of who's qualified and who's not qualified, there are very specific categories of people who fall into the definition of qualified immigrants. And mostly it applies to people who have particular types of immigration status that I'll go over. And then if you're not in any of these very particular narrow categories of being a qualified immigrant, then you are not going to be eligible for federal public benefits. There's a couple of terms that were used before these changes to the law in 1996 that define some people as PRUCAL. That may be a term that some of you have heard in your state. That stands for persons who are permanently residing under the color of law, which is essentially a way of saying the government knows you're here and they're not trying to actively remove you. So in some cases, some of what I'm going to be describing to you in terms of federal eligibility may not apply in your particular state because your state may use different rules. So that's just something to take note of in the few states like New York and California and some select states where PRUCAL is still a concept. But again, as far as the federal legislation is concerned, you're either qualified or not qualified. Moving on to the third slide, who is a qualified immigrant? This includes, again, a very specific, narrow category of immigrants who are lawfully present. It includes people who are lawful permanent residents, also known as green card holders. So that's the highest status you can achieve before citizenship. It includes people who are refugees, who've been granted asylum, so not asylum seekers, but people who've been granted it, people who have withholding of deportation or removal, conditional entrance, people who have been paroled into the United States for at least a period of at least 1 year, Cuban and Haitian entrants, certain battered immigrants and their children, and certain survivors of trafficking. So you'll see there's many, many categories of people who are not on here. For example, people who may have work visas or other types of non-immigrant visas. Many other categories of people who have temporary protected status, for example, that are not included in the definition of a qualified immigrant. So moving on to the next slide, number four, anybody who doesn't fall into that category of qualified immigrants, so any other non-citizen, again, even if you have a work permit, even if you're here with permission, you're not going to be considered a qualified immigrant. So this is a substantial change to what the rules were prior to this Welfare Reform Act from 1996. Moving on to slide five, in terms of what does it mean to be qualified versus not qualified, what does that get you or what does that bar you from? Any federal public benefits or state and local public benefits, unless the state passes a law that allows for access to those benefits, are going to be denied to anyone who doesn't fall into that qualified definition. So this is a really clear dividing line in terms of eligibility. And as I'll get into a little bit later in the presentation, states can and have made up for some of the gaps in coverage, particularly states where, for example, they were providing these services and they have a large immigrant population or they have a larger sort of social public interest in continuing to provide access to certain benefits. Many states have tried to maintain access even when it's just purely coming out of their own state budget. But obviously, that has been a challenge to maintain for certain states given resource challenges. So moving on to slide six. So if you are not considered a qualified immigrant for federal public benefits, there is a bar on access to those benefits. In terms of what programs and what benefits that includes, they have to be specifically defined by the federal agencies that administer those programs. And to date, only a very few agencies, including HHS and FEMA, have actually enumerated which programs and which programs qualify as federal public benefits. So some examples of that include certain grants or contracts, loans or commercial licenses that are provided for and funded by the government, certain retirement, welfare, disability, housing, higher education, nutrition assistance, unemployment programs. And then, again, these are for programs that are funded specifically by the federal government. So in some cases, there's a lot of agencies that haven't defined particular programs as a public benefit. And so there's potentially a lack of clarity around that. But in some cases, like with HHS, again, being the most prominent agency that has specifically defined those programs, it's very clear what the dividing line is. So just to give some more specific examples, on slide seven, you'll see a long list of many different programs, again, largely from HHS, but other agencies as well. You'll see, for example, some programs that several of you may be familiar with in your work and help clients enroll for. For example, Medicare, Medicaid, refugee benefits, the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, cash assistance through TANF, and then nutrition assistance through the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. So a lot of these programs, they are very clearly federal public benefits and means-tested public benefits that if you're not a qualified immigrant, you will not be eligible for them under the federal rules. Moving on to slide eight, I want to give some examples of programs that are exempt from the federal bar so that persons who are qualified or not qualified can still be eligible for. And so I put in bold sort of probably the most prominent example, which is emergency Medicaid. And that means that regardless of your status, regardless of your income, you will be eligible to receive emergency medical assistance and treatment, immunizations, short-term non-cash disaster relief assistance. So non-cash means like in-kind benefits like shelter or food or any type of clothing, relocation assistance, things of that nature. Other examples include certain nutrition programs like school lunches and school breakfasts, and then also the state option to provide nutrition assistance through the WIC or Women, Infant, and Children program. One thing I just want to note about that, and I will say it's sort of a developing situation in the state of Indiana. That's the first state so far that has ever put some limitations, potential limitations on access to WIC. They recently started implementing a law in Indiana that would require applicants and recipients of WIC to provide a social security number. As many of you know, not everybody will have a social security number depending on their immigration status. So that is still being challenged and, you know, perhaps not surprisingly, this has not been an issue before because most states see the benefit of making sure that pregnant women and the children that they're carrying and young infants are receiving access to vital nutrition assistance. So we do hope that that situation will be successfully challenged in Indiana, and it is, to my knowledge, the only time there's been any restriction under the state option. Generally speaking, the guidelines for which types of programs would be exempt from the federal bar to public benefits are those that are delivered at the community level, that they're not conditioned on person's income, so they're not means tested, and that they're necessary to protect the life or safety of the community. On the following slide, on slide nine, you'll see a list of some examples from the Attorney General's office that sort of provide some guidelines in terms of what they view as quote-unquote necessary to protect the life or safety of a community member. So things that, for example, are provided for child protective or adult protective services, services that are provided to survivors of domestic violence, including shelter, any sort of treatment programs for people suffering from mental illness or substance abuse, any type of disaster relief due to adverse weather conditions, soup kitchens. These types of programs would be considered exempt from the federal bar on public benefits for non-qualified immigrants. And again, the idea and the sort of spirit behind this is that if there's some broader public safety or social benefit, then we want to make sure that all community members, regardless of their status and regardless of their income, have access to these programs. Moving on to slide 10, which I'm not sure if you are able to enlarge on this, but maybe if not now, you'll be able to enlarge it later when we send around the PowerPoint, and certainly you can email me separately and I'm happy to share it. But this is a chart that I'm hoping that when you make bigger will be more legible. So I apologize for the small type, but it's a chart that shows at a glance the major means-tested federal public benefits programs. So Medicaid, CHIP, SNAP, TANF, SSI, and it shows who has access to these programs. And you'll see, without going into sort of each square in the chart, you'll see there's a lot of red X's. And if you think of the red X's as barriers or stop, these are all the categories of non-citizens who don't have access to these programs, or they may not have access, even if they're qualified immigrants, they may not have access for the first 5 years that they're in that status of being a qualified immigrant. So just to give you an example, the middle three columns are for lawful permanent residents, again, green card holders. So that's clearly people who are here with permission, people who are on a path to citizenship. Again, the highest level of status you can have before becoming a U.S. citizen. And you'll see even within these categories, we still prevent access to many of these immigrants, even though they're qualified immigrants. One notable exception you'll see is the one lone green check in that whole area right in the middle is for SNAP, for children who are under 18 who are green card holders. And I note this particular eligibility category for two reasons. One, many of you are obviously working with and representing children, and because it also represents the one pretty significant victory after the 1996 welfare reform law was passed to restore some of the benefits. And in 2002, this category of people, so green card holders who are under 18, they were able to restore access to SNAP for this population. But overwhelmingly, as you'll see, there's so many barriers, and we find this chart extremely helpful as both a public education tool, as a resource for people who are really dealing with the nitty-gritty day-to-day, but also for our policymakers who unfortunately are inundated with a lot of misinformation out there about, immigrants are really such a drain on so many programs. All you have to do is, somehow manage to get across the border and you'll be given all these different handouts. And so we really use this chart to dispel the idea that, number one, that undocumented immigrants have access to anything really, other very, 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 very limited access. And even to say, not only is it undocumented immigrants who have so many barriers, it's in fact many lawfully present and qualified immigrants who have real restrictions on access to benefits. So we find it to be a helpful tool for that reason. On the next slide, I'm going to spend a couple of quick slides. I won't go into too much detail because our next presenter will be talking in much more detail about the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. But I want to highlight the Affordable Care Act and specifically say that unlike the other programs I've mentioned so far, the ACA is not considered a federal public benefit program. It is a separate type of category, and so it is subject to completely different eligibility rules. Under the Affordable Care Act, the concept of qualified or not qualified immigrants does not exist. That is very specific to federal public benefits and the Welfare Reform Act from 1996. It's very different than the ACA. And the ACA instead uses the definition of if you are a U.S. citizen or national or lawfully present, then you're eligible for coverage under the marketplaces or exchanges. And I'll go through a little bit more on the next couple of slides of who's considered lawfully present. But lawfully present is a much, much, much broader category of non-citizens than qualified immigrants. It does not, of course, mean that everybody gets access to coverage under the ACA. So notably, who's left out? Anybody who's undocumented. And quite unfortunately, there's one category of people who are lawfully present but still excluded from the ACA, and that is the population known as the documented or DACA grantees. DACA is Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It's an initiative that the Obama administration created in 2012, specifically for young people who came to this country in their childhood or youth and who've been here for a certain number of years and have really demonstrated that they intend that the U.S. is their home. And this was the administration's way of basically providing a temporary humanitarian reprieve from deportation and the fear of deportation. Some of you may be familiar with the November 2014 announcements the president made, which included both an expanded version of this DACA program to include even more people who came here in their childhood or youth, and also a program known as DAPA, which is for parents of U.S. citizens and green card holders. Those programs are not yet up and running due to ongoing litigation that's unfortunately challenging them. However, it's our understanding, again, quite unfortunately, that once those initiatives, we hope, move forward, that those populations of people will also be excluded from coverage under the ACA. It's been a bit of a nightmare, to be honest, in dealing with that. Tax day, and so this tax season has been very challenging for a lot of people who have DACA and they are being told by their tax preparers, hey, you've got to pay the penalty because you don't have coverage, when in fact, understandably, I think tax preparers have been confused by the fact that this is a population of people who are lawfully present, but they're unfortunately not eligible under the ACA. In the interest of time, I won't go through all the categories on slides 12 and 13, but they list out all the different categories of people who are considered lawfully present under the ACA. Again, just comparing this to the earlier slide of who's a qualified immigrant, you can see the number of categories of people that are excluded from federal public benefits eligibility but are included for purposes of ACA eligibility. So a lot of different categories on slides 12 and on slide 13. So just at a glance, I'll give you all a second to look at those before I move on to slide 14. And I think everybody's following along with the slides, so I haven't seen any reports otherwise of problems. In terms of what role you all play as nonprofit service providers, it's a crucial one. You are essentially a entry point, a safe gateway for immigrant community members, many of whom experience incredible fear dealing with any government agency or anyone that they perceive to be part of the government. And your role is just so vital in really sort of breaking down a lot of the barriers. Nonprofits do not have to determine or verify someone's immigration status when providing services. And so that's really key because you are in a position to really provide a safe climate for your clients and for the communities that you're serving, as I'm sure you're all very well aware. On the following slide, on slide 15, I'm going to go into a little bit of detail about just one of several, I think, barriers that immigrants, even those who are eligible, are face when trying to access benefits. So some of you may have heard this concept of public charge, and it creates, unfortunately, a really deep fear among immigrant community members who are worried about what happens if I accept, you know, these benefits, even though I'm eligible, is this going to later haunt me in my immigration process? And the reason for this fear is that there is a determination that's made in your immigration process when you are applying either for a green card, again, also known as applying for lawful permanent residence, or if you're applying to be admitted to the United States. So let's say you're outside of the U.S., but you'd previously been here on a work visa, on a visitor visa, or if you're outside of the U.S. and applying for lawful permanent residence from outside the U.S., you will be subject to basically a series of tests to determine that you're someone that the government wants to allow to stay. And so they look at a whole host of things, your criminal record, you know, like a lot of things that come from the immigration laws to determine if they want to allow you to be admitted to the United States. And one of the things they look at is if you are or are likely to become a public charge. And what the government looks at in making that determination is, have you received public cash assistance for income maintenance, or have you been institutionalized for long-term care on the government's dime? And what ends up happening is, I think, in an understandable overabundance of caution, and I say this as a, you know, formerly practicing immigration lawyer who didn't understand public benefits as much, you know, people are so cautious and so want to preserve their clients' ability to sort of have an unencumbered path to getting a green card, that I think a lot of people are told, hey, don't accept these benefits because you could be considered a public charge. And in the end, I think that overabundance of caution has resulted in people not getting benefits that would be extremely helpful to them because they wrongly think that the receipt of those benefits will harm them in a future immigration application. So on slide 16, it looks like a couple of the slides are in just a slightly different order. So if you'll bear with me, if you skip slide 16 and go to slide 17, and then we can continue the public charge conversation. There are many categories of people who are not going to be considered or not going to be subject to a public charge test. And if you look at the list, and again, we're now on slide 17, not 16, you'll see that that includes I've just gotten a request that I think there's some background noise for folks. So if you are on your computer or anything like that, if you wouldn't mind muting, that would be great. So a lot of these categories, trafficking victims, refugees, domestic violence victims who have to self-petition, special immigrant juveniles, a lot of these categories are what we consider sort of humanitarian categories of immigrants. So they're not going through a traditional sponsorship process with a family member. And so understandably, the government has said, well, in this case, you know, we understand that these folks are in a different kind of situation, and so we're not going to subject them to a public charge test. And then another notable exception for the public charge test is for people who are applying for citizenship. So they already have their green card, and they're in the final process now. This is just important for you all to know, just in terms of if you have clients who maybe wrongly think they're going to be facing this fear, but also just to get a sense of, you know, it doesn't always pay to be too cautious, because again, you don't want your clients to be sort of self-imposing restrictions that they don't need to. And then on the next slide, on slide 18, just to give you an example of the various programs that would not harm your client and would not subject them to a public charge determination, Medicaid, the ACA, CHIP, other health insurance programs, nutrition assistance programs, disaster assistance. Again, all these things are non-cash benefits or programs, and so they will not be counted against your client if they're using them and if they're qualified to receive them. So they should not be worried about these receipt of these programs or these benefits counting against them. I'm going to just go back to slide 16 very quickly in the interest of making sure my co-presenter has time. Sponsor deeming, I'll just quickly say about that. Again, this is slide 16. It is a process by which your clients may, when they're trying to apply for benefits, they may find that income from their sponsor, the person who's sponsoring them for a green card, is being counted, even if they don't live with the sponsor or even if they're not being supported anyway by the sponsor. And one of the challenges about that is just that there's, again, this is another barrier for your clients, because even though they think of themselves as income eligible for certain programs, the way many of these programs are administered, they sort of overcount income that gives the appearance of your client having more resources available to her or him than in fact they do. And then again, I am so sorry to be bouncing around on the slides, but now we're going back in the regular order. So if you go to slide 19, I'm just quickly going to highlight a couple of key issues for mixed status families. And again, the chilling effect really can come down to, you know, you may have clients who are the adults and they have children who are eligible for various programs because, for example, the most common scenario is if the child is a U.S. citizen but the parent is undocumented, the parent, as the applicant, doesn't need to provide information or be deterred if, for example, she doesn't have a Social Security number. She's merely the applicant, and she's applying on behalf of her eligible children. And so that's an important distinction to make. And I think, unfortunately, this process, and as many of you know, the experience of enrolling for benefits for a lot of people has not been a positive one. It can be extremely humiliating in some cases if they are dealing with a frontline caseworker who, you know, is not particularly sensitive to their vulnerabilities or what they might be concerned about. So it can be very quickly a deterrent. And then just finally moving on to slide 20, and in the same spirit of that, there was guidance that was issued by several agencies specifically to really enumerate like the ways in which agencies are prohibited from either denying benefits to people who don't disclose information about themselves if it's not required, or if there's a improper or unnecessary request for information, for example, about a person's Social Security number when they're not the applicant. That really, again, all of this, all of the guidance in this memo, this tri-agency memo, was really intended to ensure and uphold Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, which is basically preventing the discrimination of anyone based on race, color, or national origin. And so they really wanted to make sure that the agencies understand you can't deny benefits to people who are not themselves applying, but they may be applying on behalf of their household member. And then the very last slide, very quickly, again, as I mentioned before, you all are sort of the ambassadors in many cases for your clients when dealing with a lot of these agencies that administer the programs. And so really detailed documentation of the harm or policies that are creating a chilling effect or a deterrent environment for your clients is really crucial, because so often agencies really want drill down specific examples of what is happening. And even though if at the highest levels, these federal agencies have good policy if the frontline workers who are administering the programs are out of sync with that, with those guidelines. That's really what makes the biggest difference in terms of your client's ability to access safely and respectfully access these programs. So you all are critical in this role, making sure your clients, don't feel like they have to give up or be deterred when they are eligible. It's really key, the role that you all play in terms of educating and empowering your clients. So I know that was quite a lot of information, and I will welcome questions at the end, but I want to make sure I preserve enough time for Elizabeth, so I apologize for running a bit over.
Thanks, Aviday. Elizabeth, if you are ready to go, your presentation is up.
Great, thank you. So my presentation is going to focus on what it's like on the ground helping immigrants and mixed status families access the benefits that are available to them under the Affordable Care Act. I worked for an affordable housing organization based in Austin, Texas. We started providing financial services to the community about 10 years ago. Our biggest program is free tax preparation. We prepare about 20,000 returns a year using a core of 500 volunteers who are trained and certified by the IRS. That program also assists people with I-10s, so we have this long history of working with undocumented in our community and mixed status families. We got started with health insurance enrollment because we had this model and infrastructure set up for free tax preparation, and we applied that to do health insurance enrollment under the Affordable Care Act. Our numbers in season two were a little lower than they were in season one, but this gives you an idea of sort of the scale we're operating at. We had 9,000 households come through our enrollment centers, and of those, we enrolled 5,500 individuals in qualified health plans through the marketplace. We serve largely Spanish speakers, Spanish-speaking immigrants, and refugees from all over the world, and this gives you an idea of just the demographics of who we're serving in Austin. We guarantee services in English and Spanish for all hours of operation 7 days a week, and then at one location, we guarantee services in Arabic 7 days a week. All that's with no appointment. People can just drop in and get their health insurance and enrollment services. We are also very effective at reaching the uninsured. So for the people we enrolled this year, 69% of those households had at least one parent who was currently uninsured. For that person who was uninsured, almost half of them had been uninsured for at least a year, 31% had been uninsured for five or more years, and of course a significant percentage of that had never had insurance at all. I was asked to talk a little bit about our outreach. In year one, we had tremendous earned media. We were on television, radio all the time. It was radio, it was interviews. They were all, because there was such bad news about the Affordable Care Act, we used that to our advantage to really get the word out to the community. Unfortunately, we did not have that this year. So this year, we distributed 30,000 flyers through a very well-established network of nonprofits and service providers that help us have been getting the word out about our tax prep for years. So they're trusted partners, the community trusts them, and those referrals are just really the bread and butter of who we serve. But we were trying to reach people who weren't plugged in to that sort of service provider network. So we purchased advertisements on Univision, and you sort of purchase sort of the main spokesperson on talk radio, you pay them to endorse your program. So we did that, and that was very effective at reaching people who weren't getting reached through the sort of grassroots network. So now the bulk of my presentation is going to talk about all the enrollment challenges you face when working with immigrants and mixed status families. And my presentation is a little too long, so I'm not going to touch on all of these points, but I'm going to jump right into misinformation. And I'm sure we're all familiar with the rampant rumors and just all the misinformation around the Affordable Care Act. The Supreme Court case didn't help. You know, people didn't know what it was, but they just heard Obamacare was going away. So they were reticent to enroll this year because they were, someone had told them that it was going away. So we had to fight that. And then just determining who is eligible for the subsidies under the Affordable Care Act presents some challenges when working with immigrants and mixed status families. And these rules apply to everyone, not just lawfully present immigrants, but it can be more challenging. So the first question you have to ask is, does your employer offer health insurance? And for most of the people we work with, they don't know. They honestly don't know the answer. Because when they got that job, they were concerned about, what's my hourly pay? What's my take home? They didn't look, you know, or review the benefits package and compare that to other offers. The other challenge is that often in the HR department, there's no one who speaks their language. So information may have been communicated, but it wasn't communicated in a way that the employee could understand. So what we have to do is then call that employer to try and get that information to determine whether or not they have an offer to see if we can go to that next step of determining if they're eligible for subsidies. So the next step is really looking at the household, who's in the household, and what their estimated income is for the upcoming year. And this is where our tax knowledge really helps, because many of the immigrant families we serve, they're claiming, you know, 5 dependents from Mexico on their tax return, which they can legitimately do if they're providing support to those individuals. So they've got nieces and nephews and siblings on their tax return. But when you're looking at it from the perspective of who's, if you're eligible for subsidies under the Affordable Care Act, and we're in a non-expansion state, they're way below 100% FPL with this household size of 10 people. So we do a little tax planning and educating them, because often they don't have a tax liability and they're not really benefiting from claiming these 10 people on their tax return. So we explain to them, you know, if you don't claim all these dependents, it's not going to impact your tax return, and it would reduce your household size and make you eligible for these really rich subsidies under the Affordable Care Act. The other thing we see is mixed status families where one spouse, say the husband, is documented and the wife is undocumented. And historically, they show us their tax return and they've been filing with the husband head of household and the wife is nowhere on the tax return, even though they live together and they are married. So we want to do the marketplace application correctly, so we have to really advise them that they need to correct their tax return going forward. And that's where our I-10 services really help out, because the I-10 gives someone who doesn't have a social, it's a number that's sort of in place of a social security number that allows someone who doesn't have a social to file their taxes. So, you know, we're helping them fix their tax return going forward and making sure that we can do the marketplace application correctly. Now, that wife who's undocumented, like the previous presentation said, is not eligible for coverage under the marketplace, but they need to be on that application because they're part of the household. So one of the interesting things about the Affordable Care Act is that when it was originally passed, and it, you know, before Medicaid expansion became optional, there are certain lawfully present immigrants below 100% of the federal poverty level who would not have been eligible for Medicaid had Medicaid been expanded in every state. So that chart that we saw earlier, all those red X's. But they are eligible for subsidies under the Affordable Care Act. So in Texas, which is a non-expansion state, it's really created an unusual situation where citizens who are below 100% of the federal poverty level are not eligible for subsidized health insurance, but there are certain lawfully present immigrants who are. Unfortunately, you can't rely on healthcare.gov when you do that application to give you accurate information. So we've developed these tools for our volunteers and staff to figure out if someone's eligible for credits, so then when they do the marketplace application, they'll know whether or not the answer they're getting on that eligibility letter is correct or not. And if it's not, we've figured out sort of various tools and tricks to essentially manipulate the application to get the correct answer and give tax credits to someone who is correctly eligible for them. So, coming from Texas, I can't really talk about the ACA without talking about the Medicaid gap, which everyone I'm sure is very familiar with. But I'd like to share a twist on that story. That's been very successful. It's an approach that's been very successful with her work with immigrants and mixed status families. So this is Alma. She's a single mother with three children. When she first came to us, and she was working at a restaurant, and the income put her in the Medicaid gap. But she really wanted health insurance. So the volunteer talked to her about how the Affordable Care Act worked, and in Texas, to qualify for subsidies under the Affordable Care Act, you needed to make a certain amount of money to be able to qualify. And she wasn't that far off. So we discussed ways she could do this. You know, she could do babysitting. She could get a second part-time job. There are certain, you know, other ways to increase her income. So Alma was very keen on this. She knew a part-time job that she'd had in the past. So she got that job, was able to increase her income, apply for subsidies through the marketplace, and get the health insurance that she very much wanted. All right, I'm almost out of time. I think I have time for one quick more vignette, and then I'll end. This is Elda. He's originally from Honduras, where he contracted polio as a child. When we met him, he's lawfully present in the U.S., but he had never seen a doctor. He's a monolingual Spanish speaker. He operates on a cash-only basis. He's adamant about that. He has zero interest in opening a bank account. And he has no computer, but he's super savvy on his phone. So we signed him up for insurance in year one, and he was very diligent about making payments with his money order. The insurance companies, although they were required to take money orders, were really not set up to do so, at least in our experience. So about four times during the year, the insurance company sent his money order back to him, and he'd call us, like, why'd they send it back? We don't know. Just send it back. So he would send it back because he was really determined to keep his insurance. Fortunately, that hasn't happened yet in 2015, so we think the insurance companies have sort of sorted out their systems so they're better able to deal with people who work on a cash-only basis. We also had a difficult time finding a Spanish-speaking doctor for Elder. When we were searching through the provider directories, it talks about, you know, services available in Spanish, but we realized that doesn't mean the doctor speaks Spanish. That just means someone in the office does. And Elder had a sort of bad experience in year one where a nurse was translating. He didn't feel like he was well heard. The nurse's Spanish really wasn't all that good. So we had to call each of the providers to find out, you know, does your doctor speak Spanish? And determine if they were in network, took new patients, and then got them signed up. So really for us, there's the challenge of reaching people, educating them. And then there's the challenge of getting them enrolled. And then there's really the biggest challenge, helping people keep and use their health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. Thank you.
Great.
Hi. Kara, do you want
Go
me
ahead,
to jump
Stephanie.
In?
Yep. Thanks so much.
Okay. Hi, everyone. I want to make sure that you still have time to ask questions, so we're going to move on quickly. And, Kara, are you pulling up my slides? Or?
Yep.
Okay. So I'm just going to go through some of these programs that we haven't talked about in detail as quickly as possible, but the slides will be here for your reference. So looking a little more deeply at the other types of benefits that non-citizens can get. In terms of income support, temporary assistance for needy families was actually created through the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Act, so at the same time as immigration reform, which was mentioned earlier in the presentation. And
states have very broad discretion to determine their eligibility for benefits and services based on work requirements and other types of child care assistance and other types of requirements. But federal law does bar states from using the TANF dollars to assist most legal immigrants unless they have been in the United States for at least 5 years. So that five-year bar, which was talked about earlier, applies to almost all legal immigrants in terms of TANF and applies to the cash assistance they receive, but also the work supports that they receive and child care assistance. Therefore, there's a lot of low-income children who have non-citizen parents who are not eligible for TANF benefits and services in mixed-status families. States can use their own state funds to provide these services, but very few states do, less than half. And then states can also choose whether to assist legal immigrants who aren't subject to that five-year bar because they came before 1996 or in the country for 5 years, and almost every state does. In terms of food assistance, the main program in the United States is SNAP, which used to be called food stamps. Close to 70% of all SNAP participants are in families with children. So this is a huge program, obviously, for children. And there's very detailed requirements for how much you can make and how much benefits you get, which we've noted on this slide and in the links for your reference. The important thing to know for children and for mixed status families is if the household contains somebody who's an ineligible non-citizen, their income might still be considered, but the whole amount will be prorated. So if you have citizen or eligible children in the household, you can still get a prorated amount of benefits to the family. In terms of the immigration eligibility rules for SNAP, they're complicated, just like for the ACA and Medicaid, so we're not going to go through them here today because we don't have enough time, but we've given them all to you and links so you can look them up afterwards if you need to on the NOC slide website. This slide lists the general eligibility rules for immigrants. States do have some flexibility in their state dollars, as I said, but most important for kids, which is what we're talking about today, is that children who are LPRs, legal permanent residents, or green card holders, it's all the same thing, or in a different lawful status, another lawful status category, and under the age of 18, they're eligible right away without that five-year wait for SNAP, so it's very important. In terms of another public assistance program that's very important to kids and families is federal housing assistance. And every program has to have their own rules, as mentioned before. So HUD, which is the agency that provides housing assistance, has their own rules for the three major programs that they administer. That would be the housing choice vouchers, Section 8 housing, and public housing. And these are either given as vouchers to public housing authorities for eligible households to have reduced rent, or private housing, which is reduced through subsidies to private landlords. In terms of how immigrants are eligible for public housing assistance, it's also a little complicated, but very importantly for families with children, which is what we're talking about today, if even one member of that household fits into the categories listed here for qualified immigrants, the whole family can apply, even to a federally restricted program. So, and that person who qualifies, if they're a citizen or a qualified immigrant, they can be a child, they can be, you know, an infant and not the head of the household. And so the whole household could receive housing assistance. As mentioned before, only the eligible immigrant needs to verify their Social Security number and the other family members do not, which is very important. And emergency and transitional housing can be provided regardless of immigration status. The way that rent is determined when you have a mixed status family, it's determined proportionately. And there's a lot of details here, which I won't go into, but the amount of the rent might be different depending on whether everyone in the family is a citizen or eligible immigrant, or if only the child is. And once the last person who's an eligible non-citizen moves out, so if a child grows up and moves out of the household, there's a time period that's given for the rest of the family to either be losing their assistance or move out. This has already been mentioned in general. We have application rules for mixed status families. Very important that the parent's income, even if they're undocumented or not eligible, might still be counted towards the child in determining if they're eligible. But the Social Security number is not required. And that's one of the things that we hear a lot among the people that we work with, the navigators for the Affordable Care Act and other care and case managers, that parents are afraid to apply because the application asks for a Social Security number. So education is very important to tell them not to use, for instance, a false Social Security number, which could really get in trouble. They don't need to put in a Social Security number at all for themselves. We've used a lot of strategies in Illinois that have been successful, including materials in other languages, grants to community-based organizations in the neighborhoods where people who speak different languages and are immigrant communities live, working with hospitals and clinics who see a large number of immigrants to connect them to all kinds of benefits. Our Attorney General's office has put out population information to make sure that people are understanding that public charge is not a barrier to benefits for many programs. And then most importantly, we cover all undocumented children in Illinois with state-only funds through a program that blends it together with Medicaid so that they're not segregated. And we've been able to keep that program going through a bipartisan coalition. So if any other states want to talk about how we did that and some of the methods that we used, we're always out there and willing to do that. And here's some helpful resources for you. So I know that was very fast, but I wanted to, Kara, leave enough time for questions.
Thank you so much, Stephanie, and thank you to all of our speakers. I know we're running out of time for questions. For anyone who is able to stay on the line for a few minutes, you can ask a question by pressing *9, and then we can unmute your line. You may also type a message, as a few of you already have, in the message box in the lower left-hand corner of your screen through the webinar technology. If you need to jump off and you ran out of time for questions, feel free to email me, Cara B, C-A-R-A, B as in boy, at firstfocus.org, and I'm happy to get you an answer to your question. Again, this webinar is being recorded, and we will have a recording, including the slides, available in the coming days. We will send it to everyone who registered. In addition, it will be posted on our website, firstfocus.org, in the coming days as well. So we had a few questions that were sent through the message box that I can start with. Again, if there's any additional questions, please feel free to type a message in the message box or press *9 on your phone. So one question that we received is, how does applying for cash assistance affect immigrant families when trying to apply for work permit or residence? And I think this was asked in the beginning. So Aviday, if you're able to answer that or others want to jump in, that would be great.
Sure. You said it was, how does receipt of cash assistance impact an application for a work permit? Is that the question?
How does applying for cash assistance affect families when applying for work permit or residence?
This goes to that question of public charge that I was mentioning before. I mean, applying for a work permit, there are many different bases for applying for a work permit. So the fact that a person receives cash assistance has no bearing on your application for a work authorization card, employment authorization card. In terms of applying for a green card or permanent residence, again, receipt of cash assistance is something that's taken into consideration for purposes of a public charge analysis. It's not, for example, like the list of other programs I mentioned, like CHIP or WIC or ACA coverage or SNAP, nutrition assistance. But receipt of cash assistance for income maintenance will be part of what a public charge analysis would include. And, you know, they really look at sort of the totality of the circumstances. You know, is that the sole source of income? How long and for what reasons was the person, the household or the person dependent on it? And again, this is assuming that a person is in a category where they're subject to a public charge determination, because Don't forget, there's that list of immigrants that I had put in a slide where those categories of people aren't going to be subject to a public charge determination.
Great, thank you. And then one other question that's related for you, Aviday, is that it is heard that a lot of immigrant parents are worried that if they accept benefits, their citizen children will not be able to request help or request for benefits later on, if you don't mind addressing that.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think this is, you know, a lot of the same questions kind of wrapped up in the same concern around, is there going to be some kind of negative consequence in the future, either for, you know, an individual, like an undocumented immigrant who later wants to get status. I think what this question is going to is, what happens if you, as the undocumented parent, for example, are not receiving benefits in your name, but your kids who are U.S. citizen children, for example, are receiving benefits. Again, that those children are the recipients of the benefits. Yes, the adults may be in the household and, of course, you know, may be benefiting from the same programs, but they're not actually, they've applied on behalf of their kids. So a parent should not pursue those benefits for their eligible children for fear of these programs being used against them in the future.
Great. Thank you, Aviday. We're not seeing any other questions pop up, and I know we have met our time limit. Again, all of the contact information for the speakers are up on the screen, including my contact information, so please feel free to reach out if you have any questions that have come up or had any difficulty asking questions. And again, we will be circulating this information in the coming days. So we really appreciate everyone who joined, and we thank Aviday, Elizabeth, and Stephanie for your presentations. They packed a lot of information in an hour, and we really appreciate it. And please, you know, continue to be on the lookout for information that is provided by the Coalition for Access and Opportunity, because we really want to get this important information of streamlining benefits and increasing access for those who need it. So thank you again, and have a great afternoon.
Thank you.
The organizer has disconnected, and this conference will continue for 60 minutes.